And this is little Terzi. He smiled fondly at the youngest.
We have a little brother, Papa,
the older girl informed him gravely.
What an amazing thing,
Barak replied, feigning a great show of astonishment.
You knew about it already,
Gundred accused him.
We wanted to be the ones to tell you,
she pouted.
His name is Unrak, and he's got red hair just the same as you have,
Terzi announced.
But he doesn't have a beard yet.
I expect that will come in time,
Barak assured her.
He yells a lot,
Gundred reported,
and he hasn't got any teeth.
Then the broad gateway to the Revan Citadel swung open, and Queen Ailina, wearing a dark red cloak, emerged from within, accompanied by a lovely blonde Orindish girl and by Meryl, Barak's wife. Meryl was dressed in all green, and she was carrying a blanket-wrapped bundle in her arms. Her expression was one of pride.
Hail, Barak, Earl of Trallheim and my husband,
she said with great formality.
Thus have I fulfilled my ultimate duty.
She extended the bundle.
Behold your son Unrak, Trallheim's heir.
With a strange expression, Barak gently set his daughters down, approached his wife, and took the bundle from her. Very gently, his great fingers trembling, he turned back the blanket to gaze for the first time at his son's face. Geryon could see only that the baby had bright red hair, much the same color as Barak's.
Hail, Unrak, heir to Trallheim, and my son,
Barak greeted the infant in his rumbling voice. Then he kissed the child in his hands. The baby boy giggled and cooed as his father's great beard tickled his face. His two tiny hands reached up and clutched at the beard, and he burrowed his face into it like a puppy.
He's got a good strong grip,
Barak commented to his wife, wincing as the infant tugged at his beard. Meryl's eyes seemed almost startled, and her expression was unreadable.
This is my son, Unrak,
Barak announced to the rest of them, holding the baby up so that they could see him.
It may be a bit early to tell, but he shows some promise.
Barak's wife had drawn herself up with pride.
You've done well, then, my lord?
Beyond all my expectations, Meryl,
he told her. Then, holding the baby in one arm, he caught her in the other and kissed her exuberantly. She seemed even more startled than before.
Let's go inside, the brutish-looking King Anheg suggested. It is very cold out here, and I am a sentimental man. I would rather not have the tears freezing in my beard.
The Orindish girl joined Lothurin and Geryon as they entered the fortress.
And this is my Arianna,
Lothurin told Geryon, with an expression of total adoration on his face. For a moment, for just a moment, Geryon had some hope for his impossible friend. Lady Arianna was a slim, practical-looking membrane girl whose medical studies had given her a face with a certain seriousness. The look she directed at Lothurin, however, immediately dispelled any hope. Geryon shuddered inwardly at the total lack of anything resembling reason in the gaze these two exchanged. Arianna would not restrain Lothurin as he crashed headlong into disaster after disaster. She would encourage him. She would cheer him on.
My lord hath awaited thy coming most eagerly,
she said to Geryon, as they followed the others along a broad stone corridor. The very slight stress she put on my lord indicated that while Lothurin might think that their marriage was one in name only, she did not.
We are very good friends,
Geryon told her. He looked around, a bit embarrassed by the way these two kept staring into each other's eyes.
Is this the Hall of the Riven King, then? "'Tis generally called so,'
Arianna replied.
The ravens themselves speak with more precision, however. Lord Olban, the youngest son of the Raven Warder, has most graciously shown us throughout the fortress. And he doth speak of this as the citadel. The Hall of the Raven King is the throne room itself.
Oh, Geryon said. I see. He looked away quickly, not wanting to see the way all thought vanished from her eyes when they returned to their contemplation of Lauldron's face. King Rodar of Drasnia, wearing his customary red robe, was sitting in the large, low-beamed dining room where a fire crackled in a cave-like fireplace, and a multitude of candles gave off a warm, golden light. Rodar vastly filled a chair at the head of a long table, with the ruins of his lunch spread before him. His crown was hung negligently on the back of his chair, and his round red face was gleaming with perspiration.
"Finally," he said with a grunt.
He waddled ponderously to greet them. He fondly embraced Poldra, kissed Queen Selar and Queen Layla, and took the hands of King Kohag and King Thorak in his own.
"It's been a long time," he said to them,
and then he turned to Belgorath.
"What took you so long?"
he asked.
"We had a long way to go, Rodar,"
the old sorcerer replied, pulling off his cloak and backing up to the broad arched fireplace.
"You don't go from here to Raxhold in a week, you know." "I hear the Jew and Tuchik finally had it out," the king said.
Silk laughed sardonically. "It was a splendid little get-together, uncle."
"I'm sorry that I missed it."
King Rodar looked inquiringly at Tenedra and Adara, his expression openly admiring.
"Ladies," he said to them, bowing politely, "if someone will introduce us, I will be more than happy to bestow a few royal kisses." "If Porin catches you kissing pretty girls, she will carve out your tripes, Rodar,"
King Anheg laughed crudely. As Aunt Paul made the introductions, Geryon drew back a few paces to consider the havoc Lauldron had caused in one short week. It was going to take months to unravel it, and there was no guarantee that it would not happen again. Indeed, that it would not happen every time the young man got loose.
"What is the matter with your friend?"
It was the Princess Tenedra, and she was tugging on Geryon's sleeve.
"What do you mean? What's the matter with him? Do you mean he's always like that?"
"Lauldron," Geryon hesitated.
"Well, Leldrin's very enthusiastic about things, and sometimes he speaks or acts without stopping to think."
Loyalty made him want to put the best face on it.
"Geryon,"
Tenedra's gaze was very direct,
"I know errands, and he is the most errandish errand I have ever met. He is so errandish that he is almost incapacitated."
Geryon quickly came to the defense of his friend. "Oh, he's not that bad."
"Really? And Lady Arianna? She is a lovely girl, a skilled physician, and utterly devoid of anything remotely resembling thought."
"They're in love," Geryon said, as if that explained everything.
"What has that got to do with it?"
"Well, love does things to people. It seems to knock holes in their judgment or something."
"What a fascinating observation,"
Tenedra replied.
"Do go on."
Geryon was too preoccupied with the problem to catch the dangerous lilt in her voice. "Well, as soon as somebody falls in love, all of the wits seem to dribble out of the bottom of his head," he continued moodily.
"What a colorful way to put it," Tenedra said.
Geryon even missed that warning. "It's almost as if it were some kind of a disease."
"Do you know something, Geryon?"
the princess said in a conversational, almost casual tone of voice.
"Sometimes you make me positively sick."
And she turned and walked away,
leaving him staring after her in open-mouthed astonishment.
"What did I say?"
he called after her, but she ignored him. After they had all dined, King Rodar turned to Belgarath.
"Do you suppose we might have a look at this orb?"
"Tomorrow," the old man answered, "we'll reveal it when it is returned to its proper place in the hall of the Raven King at midday."
"We've all seen it before, Belgarath," King Onheg asserted. "What is the harm in our having a look now?"
Belgarath shook his head stubbornly.
"There are reasons, Onheg. I think it may surprise you tomorrow, and I would not want to spoil it for anyone."
"Stop him, Durnik," Baldur said, as Aaron slipped from his seat and walked around the table toward King Rodar, his hand fumbling with the strings of the pouch at his waist.
"Oh, now, little fellow," Durnik said, catching the boy from behind and lifting him up into his arms.
"What a beautiful child," Queen Elena observed. "Who is he?"
"That's our thief," Belgarath replied. "Zadar found him someplace, raised him as a total innocent. At the moment, he seems to be the only one in the world who can touch the orb."
"Is that it in the pouch?"
Onheg asked.
Belgarath nodded. "He's caused us all some anxiety along the way. He keeps trying to give it to people. If he decides to offer you something, I don't really advise taking it."
"I wouldn't dream of it,"
Onheg agreed. As was usually the case, once Eren's attention had been diverted, he immediately seemed to forget about the orb. His gaze focused on the infant Barak was holding. As soon as Durnik set him down, he went over to look at the baby. Unrak returned the look, and some kind of peculiar recognition seemed to pass between them. Then Erend gently kissed the child in Barak's arms, and Unrak, smiling, took hold of the strange little boy's finger. Gundred and Terzi gathered close, and Barak's great face rose from the garden of children clustered about him. Geryon could clearly see the tears glistening in his friend's eyes as he looked at his wife, Meryl. The look she returned him was strangely tender. For the first time Geryon could remember, she smiled at her husband.
Chapter 11. That night, a sudden savage storm howled down from the northwest to claw at the unyielding rock of the Isle of the Winds. Great waves crashed and thundered against the cliffs, and a shrieking gale howled among the ancient battlements of Irongrip's citadel. The firm-set rock of the fortress seemed almost to shudder as the seething storm lashed again and again at the walls. Geryon slept fitfully. There was not only the shriek and bellow of the wind and the rattle of sleet against close-shuttered windows to contend with, nor the gusting drafts that blew suddenly down every corridor to set unlatched doors banging, but there were also those peculiar moments of oppressive silence that were almost as bad as the noise. Strange dreams stalked his sleep that night. Some great momentous and unexplained event was about to take place, and there were all manner of peculiar things that he had to do in preparation for it. He did not know why he had to do them, and no one would tell him if he were doing them right or not. There seemed to be some kind of dreadful hurry, and people kept rushing him from one thing to the next, without ever giving him time to make sure that anything was really finished. Even the storm seemed to be mixed up in it, like some howling enemy trying with noise and wind and crashing waves to break the absolute concentration necessary to complete each task.
"Are you ready?"
It was Aunt Paul, and she was placing a long-handled kitchen kettle on his head like a helmet, and handing him a pot-lid shield and a wooden stick sword.
"What am I supposed to do?"
he demanded of her.
"You know," she replied. "Hurry now. It's getting late."
"No, Aunt Paul, I don't really..."
"Of course you do.
Now stop wasting time. He looked around, feeling very confused and apprehensive. Not far away, Rundareg stood with that same rather foolish look on his face that had always been there. Rundareg also had a kettle on his head, a pot-lid shield, and a wooden sword. Apparently he and Rundareg were supposed to do this together. Garion smiled at his friend, and Rundareg grinned back. "That's right," Aunt Paul said encouragingly. "Now kill him. Hurry, Garion. You have to be finished by supper time." He spun around to stare at her. "Kill Rundareg?" But when he looked back, it was not Rundareg. Instead, the face that looked at him from beneath the kittle was maimed and hideous.
"No, no," Barak said impatiently. "Don't hold it like that. Grip it in both hands and keep it pointed at his chest. Keep the point low so that when he charges he doesn't knock the spear aside with his tusks. Now, do it again. Try to get it right this time. Hurry, Garion. We don't have all day, you know."
The big man nudged the dead boar with his foot, and the boar got up and began to paw at the snow. Barak gave Garion a quick look.
"Are you ready?"
Then he was standing on a strange, colorless plain, and there seemed to be statues all around him. No, not statues, figures. King Anheg was there, or a figure that looked like him, and King Coradulin, and Queen Alina, and there was the Earl of Jarvik, and over there was Nechak, the Murgo ambassador at Vomimbre. "Which piece do you want to move?" It was the dry voice in his mind. "I don't know the rules," Garion objected. "That doesn't matter. You have to move. It's your turn." When Garion turned back, one of the figures was rushing at him. It wore a cowled robe, and its eyes bulged with madness. Without thinking, Garion raised his hand to ward off the figure's attack. "Is that the move you want to make?" the voice asked him. "I don't know." "It's too late to change it now. You have already touched him. From now on, you have to make your own moves. Is that one of the rules?" "That's the way it is. Are you ready?" There was the smell of loam and of ancient oak trees.
"You really must learn to control your tongue, Palgara,"
Asherak the Murgo said with a bland smile, slapping Aunt Paul sharply across the face. "It's your move again," the dry voice said. "There's only one that you can make." "Do I have to do it? Isn't there anything else I can do?" "It's the only move there is. You'd better hurry." With a deep sigh of regret, Garion reached out and set fire to Asherak with the palm of his hand. A sudden gusting draft banged open the door of the room Garion shared with Lalduran, and the two of them sat bolt upright in their beds.
"I will latch it again," Lalduran said, throwing back the covers and stumbling across the chilly stones of the floor. "How long is it going to keep blowing like this?"
Garion asked peevishly.
"How's anyone supposed to sleep with all this noise?"
Lalduran closed the door again, and Garion heard him fumbling around in the darkness. There was a scraping click and a sudden bright spark. The spark went out, and Lalduran tried again. This time it caught in the tinder. The young Astorian blew on it, and it grew brighter, then flared into a small finger of flame.
"Have you got any idea what time it is?"
Garion asked as his friend lighted the candle.
"Some hours before dawn, I imagine,"
Lalduran replied. Garion groaned.
"Feels like this night's already been about 10 years long."
"We can talk for a while," Lalduran suggested. "Maybe the storm will die down toward dawn." "Talking's better than lying here in the dark, jumping at every sound,"
Garion agreed, sitting up and pulling his blanket around his shoulders.
"Things have happened to you since we saw each other last, haven't they, Garion?"
Lalduran asked, climbing back into his own bed.
"A lot of things," Garion told him. "Not all of them good, either."
You have changed a great deal, Lulderin noted.
I've been changed. There's a difference. Most of it wasn't my idea. You have changed too, you know.
Me? Lulderin laughed ruefully.
I'm afraid not, my friend. The mess I've made of things in the past week is proof that I have not changed at all.
That will take a bit of straightening out, won't it? Garion agreed.
The funny part about it all is that there is a perverse sort of logic about the whole thing. There wasn't one single thing you did that was actually insane. It's just when you put them all together that it starts to look like a catastrophe.
Lulderin sighed.
And now my poor Eriana and I are doomed to perpetual exile.
I think we will be able to fix it, Garion assured him. Your uncle will forgive you, and Torrison probably will, too. He likes you too much to stay angry for long. Baron Altarain is probably very put out with you, but he's a membrate errand. He'll forgive anything if it's done for love. We might have to wait until his leg heals up again, though. That was the part that was a real blunder, Lulderin. You shouldn't have broken his leg.
Next time, I will try to avoid that,
Lulderin promised quickly.
Next time?
They both laughed then, and talked on as their candle flickered in the vagrant drafts stirred by the raging storm. After an hour or so, the worst of the gale seemed to pass, and the two of them found their eyes growing heavy once more.
"Why don't we try to sleep again?" Garion suggested.
"I will blow out the candle,"
Lulderin agreed. He got up out of bed and stepped to the table.
"Are you ready?"
he asked Garion. Garion slept again almost immediately, and almost immediately heard a sibilant whisper in his ear and felt a dry, cold touch.
"Are you ready?"
the whispering voice hissed, and he turned to look with uncomprehending eyes at the face of Queen Salmisra, a face that shifted back and forth from woman to snake to something midway between. Then he stood beneath the shimmering dome of the Cave of the Gods, and moved without thought to touch the unblemished, walnut-colored shoulder of the stillborn colt, thrusting his hand into the absolute silence of death itself.
"Are you ready?"
Belgarath asked quite calmly.
"I think so."
"All right. Put your will against it, and push."
"It's awfully heavy, Grandfather."
"You don't have to pick it up, Garion. Just push it. It will roll over if you do it right. Hurry up. We have a great deal more to do."
Garion began to gather his will. And then he sat on a hillside with his cousin Adara. In his hand, he held a dead twig and a few wisps of dry grass.
"Are you ready?"
the voice in his mind asked him.
"Is this going to mean anything?"
Garion asked.
"I mean, will it make any difference?"
"That depends upon you.
And how well you do it."
"That's not a very good answer."
"It wasn't a very good question.
If you are ready, turn the twig into a flower." Garion did that and looked critically at the result.
"It's not a very good flower, is it?"
he apologized.
"It will have to do,"
the voice told him.
"Let me try it again."
"What are you going to do with this one?"
"I'll just..."
Garion raised his hand to obliterate the defective bloom he had just created.
"That's forbidden, you know,"
the voice reminded him.
"I made it, didn't I?"
"That has nothing to do with it. You cannot unmake it. It will be fine. Come along now, we have to hurry."
"I'm not ready yet."
"That's too bad. We can't wait any longer."
And then Garion woke up. He felt oddly lightheaded, as if his troubled sleep had done him more harm than good. Lulderin was still deep in slumber, and Garion found his clothes in the dark, pulled them on, and quietly left the room. The strange dream nagged at his mind as he wandered in the dimly lighted corridors of Iron Grip's citadel. He still felt that pressing urgency and the peculiar sense that everyone was waiting impatiently for him to do something. He found a windswept courtyard where snow had piled up in the corners and the stones were black and shiny with ice. Dawn was just breaking, and the battlements surrounding the courtyard were etched sharply against a sky filled with scudding clouds. Beyond the courtyard lay the stables, warm, smelling of fragrant hay and of horses. Darnac had already found his way there. As was so frequently the case, the smith was uncomfortable in the presence of nobility, and he sought the company of the animals instead.
"Couldn't you sleep either?"
he asked as Geryon entered the stable. Geryon shrugged.
"For some reason, sleep just made things worse. I feel as if my head's stuffed full of straw."
"Joyous Eristai, Geryon,"
Durnick said then.
"That's right, isn't it?"
In all of the rush, the holiday seemed to have crept up on him.
"Joyous Eristai, Durnick."
The colt, who had been sleeping in a back stall, nickered softly as he caught Geryon's scent, and Geryon and Durnick went back to where the small animal stood.
"Joyous Eristai, horse,"
Geryon greeted him a bit whimsically. The colt nuzzled at him.
"Do you think that storm's blown over completely?"
Geryon asked Durnick as he rubbed the colt's ears.
"Or is there more on the way?"
"There's a smell of being over," Durnick answered. "Weather could smell differently here on this island, though."
Geryon nodded his agreement, patted the colt's neck, and turned toward the door.
"I suppose I'd better go find Aunt Paul," he said. "She was saying something last night about wanting to check my clothes. If I make her look for me, she'll probably make me wish I hadn't."
"Age is bringing you wisdom, I see," Durnick grinned at him. "If anyone wants me, I'll be here."
Geryon put his hand briefly on Durnick's shoulder, and then left the stable to go looking for Aunt Paul. He found her in the company of women in the apartment that appeared to have been set aside for her personal use centuries before. Adara was there, and Taiba, Queen Layla, and Ariana, the Mimbrate girl. In the center of the room stood Princess Tenedra.
"You're up early,"
Aunt Paul observed, her needle flickering as she made some minute modification to Tenedra's creamy gown.
"I had trouble sleeping,"
he told her, looking at the princess with a certain puzzlement. She looked different somehow.
"Don't stare at me, Geryon,"
she told him rather primly.
"What have you done to your hair?"
he asked her. Tenedra's flaming hair had been elaborately arranged, caught at brow and temples, by a gold coronet in the form of a band of twined oak leaves. There was some rather intricate braiding involved at the back, and then the coppery mass flowed smoothly down over one of her tiny shoulders.
"Do you like it?"
she asked him.
"That's not the way you usually wear it,"
he noted.
"We are all aware of that, Geryon,"
she replied loftily. Then she turned and looked rather critically at her reflection in the mirror.
"I am still not convinced about the braiding, Lady Polgra,"
she fretted.
"Though Nedran ladies don't braid their hair, this makes me look like an Aelorn."
"Not entirely, Tenedra,"
Adara murmured.
"Well, you know what I mean, Adara. All those buxom blondes with their braids and their milkmaid complexions."
"Isn't it a little early to be getting ready?"
Geryon asked.
"Grandfather said that we weren't going to take the orb to the throne room until noon."
"That's not really that far off, Geryon," Aunt Paul told him, biting a thread and stepping back to look critically at Tenedra's dress.
"What do you think, Layla?"
"She looks just like a princess, Paul,"
Queen Layla gushed.
"She is a princess, Layla,"
Aunt Paul reminded the plump little queen. Then she turned to Geryon.
"Get some breakfast, and have someone show you the way to the baths,"
she instructed.
"They're in the cellars under the west wing. After you have bathed, you will need a shave. Try not to cut yourself. I don't want you bleeding all over your good clothes." "Do I have to wear all of that?"
She gave him a look that immediately answered that question, as well as several others he might have asked.
"I'll go find Silk," he agreed quickly. "He'll know where the baths are."
"Do that," she told him quite firmly.
"And don't get lost. When the time comes, I want you to be ready."
Geryon nodded and left. Her words had somehow strangely echoed the words of his dream, and he wondered about that as he went looking for Silk. The little man was lounging in the company of the others in a large torch-lighted room in the west wing. The kings were there, with Brand, Belgarath, and Geryon's other friends. They were breakfasting on cakes and hot spiced wine.
"Where did you go this morning?" Lodron asked him.
"You were gone when I woke up?"
"I couldn't sleep anymore," Geryon replied.
"Why did you not wake me?
Did you lose sleep just because I'm having a restless night?"
Geryon could see that they were in a deep discussion, and he sat down quietly to wait for the opportunity to speak to Silk.
"I think we have managed to aggravate Tuarulgas pretty thoroughly in the past couple of months," Barak was saying.
The big man was sprawled deep in a high-backed chair with his face sunk in the shadows from the flaring torches behind him.
"First Rev steals Silk right out from under his nose. Then Belgarath destroys Tuchik and knocks down Rachtol in the process of taking back the orb. And finally, Hohag and Hettar exterminate a sizable piece of his army when he tries to follow us. The King of the Murgos has had a bad year."
The big man's chuckling rumbled out of the shadows. For a moment, a fleeting instant, Geryon seemed to see a different shape sprawled there. Some trick of the flickering light and dancing shadows made it appear momentarily that a great shaggy bear sat in Barak's place. Then it was gone. Geryon rubbed at his eyes and tried to shake off the half-bemused reverie that had dogged him all morning.
"I still don't quite follow what you mean about Relg going into the rock to rescue Prince Keldar," King Fulrak frowned.
"Do you mean that he can burrow through?"
"I don't think you'd understand unless you saw it, Fulrak," Belgarath told him. "Show him, Relg."
The Ulgo zealot looked at the old man, then walked over to the stone wall beside the large window. Silk instantly turned his back, shuddering.
"I still can't stand to watch that," he declared to Geryon.
"Aunt Paul said I was supposed to ask you the way to the baths," Geryon said quietly. "She wants me to get cleaned up and shaved, and then I guess I'm supposed to put on my best clothes."
"I'll go with you," Silk offered. "I am sure that all of these gentlemen are going to be fascinated by Rolg's demonstration, and they'll want him to repeat it."
"What's he doing?" "He stuck his arm through the wall, and he's wiggling his fingers at them from outside the window," Geryon reported.
Silk glanced once over his shoulder, then shuddered again and quickly averted his eyes.
"That makes my blood cold," he said with revulsion. "Let's go bathe."
"I will go along," Lulduran said, and the three of them quietly left the room.
The baths were in a cavernous cellar beneath the west wing of the citadel. There were hot springs deep in the rock, and they bubbled up to fill the tiled chambers with steam and a faintly sulfurous smell. There were a few torches and only one attendant, who wordlessly handed them towels and then went off into the steam to manage the valves that adjusted the water temperature.
"The big pool there gets hotter the closer you go toward the far end," Silk told Geryon and Lalduran as they all disrobed.
"Some people say that you should go in until it's as hot as you can stand it, but I prefer just to pick a comfortable temperature and soak."
He splashed down into the water.
"Are you sure we'll be alone here?" Geryon asked nervously. "I don't think I'd care to have a group of ladies come trooping in while I'm trying to bathe."
"The women's baths are separate," Silk assured him.
The Rivens are very proper about that sort of thing. They aren't nearly as advanced as the Tolmedrans, yet.
Are you really sure that bathing in the winter time is healthy?
Lulduran asked, eyeing the steaming water suspiciously. Geryon plunged into the pool and moved quickly out of the tepid water at the near end toward the hotter area. The steam rose more thickly as he waded out into the pool, and the pair of torches set in rings on the back wall receded into a kind of ruddy glow. The tiled walls echoed back the sounds of their voices and the splashing, with a peculiar cavern-like hollowness. The steam eddied up out of the water, and he found himself suddenly shut off by it, separated from his friends and the hazy dimness. The hot water relaxed him, and he seemed almost to want to float, half aware, and let it all soak out of his memory, all of the past and all of the future. Dreamily he lay back, and then, not knowing why, he allowed himself to sink beneath the dark, steaming water. How long he floated, his eyes closed and all senses suspended, he could not have said. But finally his face rose to the surface, and he stood up, the water streaming out of his hair and down across his shoulders. He felt strangely purified by his immersion. And then the sun broke through the tattered cloud outside for a moment, and a single shaft of sunlight streamed down through a small grilled window to fall fully upon Geryon. The sudden light was diffused by the steam and seemed to flicker with an opalescent fire.
"Hail, Belgerion," the voice in his mind said to him. "I greet thee on this Eristide."
There was no hint of the usual amusement in the voice, and the formality seemed strange, significant.
"Thank you,"
Geryon replied gravely, and they did not speak again. The steam rose and eddied about him as he waded back toward the cooler reaches of the pool, where Silk and Lulduran, both sunk to their necks in warm water, were talking quietly together. About half an hour before noon, Geryon, in response to a summons from Aunt Paul, walked down a long stone corridor toward a room a few steps from the huge carved doors that gave entrance into the hall of the Riven King. He was wearing his best doublet and hose, and his soft leather half-boots had been brushed until they glowed. Aunt Paul wore a deep blue robe, cowled and belted at the waist. For once Belgarath, also blue-robed, did not look rumpled or spotted. The old man's face was very serious. As he and Aunt Paul spoke together, there was no hint of the banter that usually marked their conversation. Seated quietly in the corner of the little room, Erend, dressed all in white linen, gravely watched.
"You look very nice, Geryon,"
Aunt Paul said, reaching out to smooth his sandy hair back from his forehead.
"Shouldn't we go inside?"
Geryon asked. He had seen others, gray-clad Rivens and the more brightly garbed visitors, entering the hall.
"We will, Geryon," she replied. "All in good time."
She turned to Belgarath.
"How long?"
"Another quarter hour or so," he replied.
"Is everything ready?"
"Ask Geryon," the old man told her. "I have taken care of everything that I can. The rest is up to him."
Aunt Paul turned to Geryon then, her eyes very serious, and the white lock at her brow gleaming silver in the darkness of her hair.
"Well, Geryon, are you ready?"
He looked at her, baffled.
"I had the oddest dream last night. Everyone kept asking me that same question. What does it mean, Aunt Paul? Am I ready for what?"
"That will become clearer in a bit," Belgarath told him. "Take out your amulet. You will wear it on the outside of your clothes today."
"I thought it was supposed to be out of sight."
"Today is different," the old man replied. "As a matter of fact, today is unlike any day I have ever seen, and I have seen a lot of them."
"Because it's Eristide?"
"That's part of it.
Belgareth reached inside his robe and drew out his own silver medallion. He glanced at it briefly.
"It is getting a little worn," he noted,
then smiled.
"But then, so am I suppose."
Aunt Paul drew out her own amulet. She and Belgareth each reached out to take Geryon's hands, and then to join their own.
"It has been a long time coming, Polgara,"
Belgareth said.
"Yes, it has, Father,"
Aunt Paul agreed.
"Any regrets?"
"I can live with them, old wolf."
"Let's go in, then."
Geryon started toward the door.
"Not you, Geryon," Aunt Paul told him. "You will wait here with Erend. You two will come in later." "You'll send someone for us?" he asked her. "What I mean is, how will we know when we're supposed to come in?"
"You'll know," Belgareth told him.
And then they left him alone with Erend.
"They didn't give us a very complete instruction now, did they?"
Geryon said to the child.
"I hope we don't make any mistakes."
Erend smiled confidently, reached out and put his small hand in Geryon's. At his touch, the song of the orb filled Geryon's mind again, sponging away his worries and doubts. He could not have said how long he stood holding the child's hand and immersed in that song.
"It's come at last, Belgareth."
The voice seemed to come from outside somehow, no longer confined within Geryon's mind, and the look on Erend's face made it quite clear that he could also hear the words.
"Is this what I'm supposed to do?"
Geryon asked.
"It is part of it."
"What are they doing in there?"
Geryon looked rather curiously toward the door.
"They are getting the people in the hall ready for what's going to happen."
"Will they be ready?"
"Will you?"
There was a pause.
"Are you ready, Belgareth?"
"Yes," Geryon replied. "Whatever it is, I think I'm ready for it."
"Let's go, then."
"You will tell me what to do?"
"If it's necessary."
With his hand still holding Erend's, Geryon walked toward the door. He raised his other hand to push it open, but it swung inexplicably open ahead of him before he touched it. There were two guards at the huge carved door a few steps down the hall, but they seemed frozen into immobility as Geryon and Erend approached. Once again Geryon raised his hand, and the immense doors to the Hall of the Riven King swung silently open in response to his hand alone. The Hall of the Riven King was a huge vaulted throne room with massive and ornately carved wooden buttresses supporting the ceiling beams. The walls were festooned with banners and green boughs, and hundreds of candles burned in iron sconces. Three great stone fire pits were set at intervals in the floor. Instead of logs, blocks of peat glowed in the pits, radiating an even, fragrant warmth. The hall was crowded, but there was a broad avenue of blue carpet leading from the doors to the throne. Geryon's eyes, however, scarcely noted the crowd. His thoughts seemed suspended by the song of the orb, which now filled his mind completely. Bemused, freed of all thought or fear or hint of self-consciousness, he walked with Erend close beside him toward the front of the hall, where Aunt Paul and Belgareth stood, one on each side of the throne. The throne of the Riven King had been chiseled from a single basalt block. Its back and arms were all one height, and there was a massiveness about it that made it seem more permanent than the mountains themselves. It sat solidly against the wall, and hanging point downward above it was a great sword. Somewhere in the citadel, a bell had begun to peal, and the sound of it mingled with the song of the orb as Geryon and Erend moved down the long carpeted pathway toward the front of the hall. As they passed each sconce, the candles inexplicably dropped to the merest pinpoint. There was no draft, no flickering. As one by one the candles dimmed, and the hall filled with a deepening shadow. When they reached the front of the hall, Belgareth, his face a mystery, looked gravely at them for a moment, and then looked out at the throng assembled in the hall of the Raven King.
"Behold, the Orb of Aldor,"
he announced in a solemn voice. Arand released Geryon's hand, tugged open the pouch, and reached inside. As he turned to face the darkened hall, Arand drew the round gray stone out of the pouch and lifted it with both hands, displaying it for all to see. The song of the orb was overpowering. Joining with it, there was a kind of vast, shimmering sound. The sound seemed to roar, rising, ringing higher and higher, as Geryon stood beside the child, looking at the faces of the assemblage. Within the stone, Arand held aloft, there seemed to be a pinpoint of intense blue light. The light grew brighter as the shimmering sound rose higher. The faces before him were all familiar. Barak was there, and Lulduran, Hetar, Durnik, Silk, and Mandoralan. Seated in a royal box beside the Tolnedran ambassador, with Adara and Arianna directly behind her, was Synhedra, looking every inch an imperial princess. But mingled somehow with the familiar faces were others. Strange, stark faces, each so caught up in a single overriding identity that they seemed almost mask-like. Mingled with Barak was the dreadful bear, and Hetar bore with him the sense of thousands upon thousands of horses. With Silk stood the figure of the guide, and with Relg, that of the blind man. Lulduran was the archer, and Mandoralan the knight protector. Seeming to hover in the air above Taiba was the sorrowing form of the mother of the race that died, and her sorrow was like the sorrow of Mara. And Synhedra was no longer a princess, but now a queen, the one Tuchik had called Queen of the World. Strangest of all, Durnik, a good, solid Durnik, stood with his two lives plainly evident on his face. In the searing blue light of the orb, and with the strange sound shimmering in his ears, Geryon looked in wonder at his friends, realizing with amazement that he was seeing for the first time what Belgarath and Aunt Paul had seen all along. From behind him he heard Aunt Paul speak, her voice calm and very gentle. "Your task is completed, Arand. You may now give up the orb." The little boy crowed with delight, turned and presented the glowing orb to Geryon. Uncomprehending, Geryon stared at the fiery stone. He could not take it. It was death to touch the orb. "Reach forth thy hand, Belgarion. Receive thy birthright from the child who hath borne it unto thee." It was the familiar voice, and yet at the same time it was not. When this voice spoke, there was no possibility of refusal. Geryon's hand stretched out, without his even being aware that it was moving.
"Arand,"
the child declared, firmly depositing the orb in Geryon's outstretched hand. Geryon felt the peculiar seething touch of it against the mark on his palm. It was alive. He could feel the life in it, even as he stared in blank incomprehension at the living fire that he held in his naked hand. "Return the orb to the pommel of the sword of the Riven King," the voice instructed, and Geryon turned with instant, unthinking obedience. He stepped up onto the seat of the basalt throne, and then onto the wide ledge, formed by its back and arms. He stretched up, taking hold of the huge sword hilt to steady himself, and placed the orb on the great sword's pommel. There was a faint but clearly audible click as the orb and the sword became one, and Geryon could feel the living force of the orb surging down through the hilt he gripped in one hand. The great blade began to glow, and the shimmering sound rose yet another octave. Then the huge weapon quite suddenly came free from the wall to which it had been attached for so many centuries. The throng in the hall gasped. As the sword began to drop free, Geryon caught hold of the hilt with both hands, half-turning as he did so, striving to keep the great blade from falling to the floor. What pulled him off balance was the fact that it had no apparent weight. The sword was so huge that he should not have been able to hold it, much less lift it. But as he braced himself with his feet widespread and his shoulders pressed back against the wall, the point of the sword rose easily until the great blade stood upright before him. He stared at it in amazement, feeling a strange throbbing between the hands that he had clasped about the hilt. The orb flared and began to pulsate. Then, as the shimmering sound soared into a mighty crescendo of jubilation, the sword of the Raven King burst into a great tongue of searing blue flame. Without knowing why, Geryon lifted the flaming sword over his head, with both hands, staring up at it in wonder.
"Let Aloria rejoice,"
Beldrath called out in a voice like thunder,
"for the Raven King has returned. All hail Belgarion, King of Riva, and Overlord of the West."
And yet, in the midst of the turmoil that followed, and even with the shimmering chorus of what seemed a million voices raised in an exultation echoing from one end of the universe to the other, there was a sullen clang of iron, as if the rust-scoured door of some dark tomb had suddenly burst open, and the sound of that clanging chilled Geryon's heart. A voice echoed hollowly from the tomb, and it did not join the universal rejoicing. Ripped from its centuries of slumber, the voice in the tomb awoke raging and crying out for blood. Stunned past all thought, Geryon stood with his flaming sword aloft as, with a steely rustle, the assembled Aelorns unsheathed their swords to raise them in salute.
"Hail, Belgarion, my king!"
Brand, the Raven Warder, boomed, sinking to one knee and lifting his sword. His four sons knelt behind him, their swords also lifted.
"Hail, Belgarion, King of Riva!" they cried.
"Hail, Belgarion!"
The great shout shook the hall of the Raven King, and a forest of upraised swords glittered in the fiery blue light of the flaming blade in Geryon's hands. Somewhere within the citadel, a bell began to peal. As the news raced through the breathless city below, other bells caught the sound, and their iron rejoicing echoed back from the rocky crags to announce to the icy waters of the sea the return of the Raven King. One in the hall, however, did not rejoice. In the instant that the kindling of the sword had irrevocably announced Geryon's identity, Princess Tsinedra had started to her feet, her face deathly pale, and her eyes wide with absolute consternation. She had instantly grasped something that had eluded him, something so unsettling that it drained the color from her face and brought her to her feet to stare at him with an expression of total dismay. Then there suddenly burst from the lips of the Imperial Princess Tenedra a wail of outrage and protest. With a voice that rang in the rafters, she cried out,
"Oh, no!"
Chapter 12. The worst part of it all was that people kept bowing to him. Geryon had not the slightest idea of how he should respond. Should he bow back? Should he nod slightly in acknowledgement? Or, perhaps, might it not be better just to ignore the whole business and act as if he had not seen it, or something? But what was he supposed to do when someone called him, "Your Majesty"? The events of the previous day were still a confused blur in his mind. He seemed to remember being presented to the people of the city, standing on the battlements of Iron Grip's citadel with a great cheering throng below and the huge sword that somehow seemed weightless still blazing in his hands.
Stupendous as they were, however, the overt events of the day were unimportant when compared to things which were taking place on a different level of reality. Enormous forces had focused on the moment of the revelation of the Riven King, and Geryon was still numb as a result of things he had seen and perceived in that blinding instant when he had at last discovered who he was. There had been endless congratulations and a great many preparations for his coronation, but all of that blurred in his mind. Had his life depended upon it, he could not have given a rational, coherent account of the day's events. Today promised to be even worse, if that were possible. He had not slept well. For one thing, the great bed in the royal apartments to which he had been escorted the previous evening was definitely uncomfortable. It had great round posts rising from each corner, and it was canopied and curtained in purple velvet. It seemed much too large for him, and it was noticeably on the soft side. For the past year and more, he had done most of his sleeping on the ground, and the down-filled mattress on the royal bed was too yielding to be comfortable. There was, moreover, the sure and certain knowledge that as soon as he arose, he was going to be the absolute center of attention. On the whole, he decided, it might just be simpler to stay in bed. The more he thought about that, the better it sounded. The door to the royal bedchamber, however, was not locked. Sometime, not long after sunrise, it swung open, and Geryon could hear someone moving around. Curious, he peeked through the purple drapery enclosing his bed. A sober-looking servant was busily opening the drapes at the window and stirring up the fire. Geryon's attention, however, moved immediately to the large covered silver tray sitting on the table by the fireplace. His nose recognized sausage and warm, fresh-baked bread and butter. There was definitely butter involved somewhere on that tray. His stomach began to speak to him in a loud voice. The servant glanced around the room to make sure everything was in order, then came to the bed with a no-nonsense expression. Geryon burrowed quickly back under the covers. "Breakfast, Your Majesty," the servant announced firmly, drawing the curtains open and tying them back. Geryon sighed. Quite obviously, decisions about staying in bed were not his to make. "Thank you," he replied. "Does Your Majesty require anything else?" the servant asked, holding open a robe for Geryon to put on.
No. Not right now, thank you," Geryon answered, climbing out of the royal bed and down the three carpeted steps leading up to it.
The servant helped him into the robe, then bowed and quietly left the room. Geryon went to the table, seated himself, lifted the cover from the tray, and assaulted breakfast vigorously. When he had finished eating, he sat for a long time in a large blue upholstered armchair, looking out the window at the snowy crags looming above the city. The storm that had raked the coast for days had blown off, at least for the moment. The winter sun was bright, and the morning sky very blue. The young Riven King stared for a time out his window, lost in thought. Something nagged at the back of his memory. Something he had heard once, but had since forgotten. It seemed that there was something he ought to remember that involved Princess Tenedra. The tiny girl had fled from the hall of the Riven King almost immediately after the sword had so flamboyantly announced his identity the previous day. He was fairly sure that it was all mixed together. Whatever it was that he was trying to recall had been directly involved in her flight. With some people, it might be better to let things quiet down before clearing the air, but Geryon knew that this was not the proper way to deal with Tenedra. Things should never be allowed to fester in her mind. That only made matters worse. He sighed and began to dress. As he walked purposefully through the corridors, he met with startled looks and hasty bows. He soon realized that the events of the preceding day had forever robbed him of his anonymity. Someone, Garion could never catch a glimpse of his face, even went so far as to follow him, probably in the hope of performing some service. Whoever it was kept a discreet distance behind, but Garion caught occasional glimpses of him far back along the corridor, a gray-cloaked man who moved on strangely noiseless feet. Garion did not like being followed, whatever the reason, but he resisted the urge to turn around and tell the man to go away. The Princess Tenedra had been given several rooms just down the hall from Aunt Paul's apartments, and Garion steeled himself as he raised his hand to rap on the door.
"Your Majesty,"
Tenedra's maid greeted him with a startled curtsy.
"Would you please ask Her Highness if I might have a word with her?"
Garion asked.
"Certainly, Your Majesty,"
she replied and darted into the next chamber. There was a brief murmur of voices, and then Tenedra swept into the room. She wore a plain gown, and her face was as pale as it had been the previous day.
"Your Majesty,"
she greeted him in an icy voice, and then curtsied, a stiff little curtsy that spoke whole volumes.
"Something's bothering you," Garion said bluntly. "Would you like to get it out in the open?"
"Whatever Your Majesty wishes,"
she replied.
"Do we have to do this?"
"I cannot imagine what Your Majesty is talking about."
"Don't you think we know each other well enough to be honest?"
"Of course. I suppose I'd better accustom myself to obeying Your Majesty immediately."
"And what's that supposed to mean?"
"Don't pretend that you don't know,"
she flared at him.
"Tenedra, I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about."
She looked at him suspiciously. Then her eyes softened just a bit.
"Perhaps you don't at that,"
she murmured.
"Have you ever read the Accords of Vomimbre?"
"You taught me how to read yourself," he reminded her, "about 6 or 8 months ago. You know every book I've read. You gave me most of them yourself."
"Well, that is true, isn't it?"
she said.
"Wait just a moment. I'll be right back."
She went briefly into the adjoining room and returned with a rolled parchment.
"I'll read it to you,"
she told him.
"Some of the words are a little bit difficult."
"I'm not that stupid,"
he objected. But she had already begun to read.
"And when it shall come to pass that the Riven King returns, he shall have the lordship and dominion, and swear we all fealty to him as overlord of the kingdoms of the West. And he shall have a imperial princess of Tolnedra to wife and—"
"Wait a minute,"
Garion interrupted her with a strangled note in his voice.
"Was there something you didn't understand? It all seems quite clear to me."
"What was that last part again?"
"He shall have an imperial princess of Tolnedra to wife and—"
"Are there any other princesses in Tolnedra?"
"Not that I know of."
"Then that means—"
He gaped at her.
"Precisely."
She said it like a steel trap suddenly snapping shut.
"Is that why you ran out of the hall yesterday?"
"I did not run."
"You don't want to marry me."
It was almost an accusation.
"I didn't say that."
"Then you do want to marry me?"
"I didn't say that either. But it doesn't really matter, does it? We don't have any choice at all, neither one of us."
"Is that what's bothering you?"
Her look was lofty.
"Of course not. I have always known that my husband would be selected for me."
"Well, what's the problem, then?"
"I am an imperial princess, Garion."
"I know that.
I'm not accustomed to being anyone's inferior."
"Inferior?
To who? I mean, whom?" "The Accords state that you are the overlord of the West."
"What does that mean?"
"It means, Your Majesty, that you outrank me."
"Is that all that's got you so upset?"
Her look was like a drawn dagger.
"With Your Majesty's permission, I believe I'd like to withdraw."
And without waiting for an answer, she swept from the room. Garion stared after her. This was going too far. He considered immediately going to Aunt Paul to protest, but the more he thought about it, the more convinced he became that she would be totally unsympathetic.
Too many little things began to click together all at once. Aunt Paul was not merely a party to all of this. She had actively done everything in her power to make absolutely sure that there was no escape for him. He needed someone to talk to. Someone devious enough and unscrupulous enough to think of a way out of this. He left Zinedra's sitting room and went looking for Silk. The little man was not in his room, and the servant who was making up the bed kept bowing as he stammered out his apologies at not having the slightest notion of where Silk might be. Geryon left quickly. Since the apartment Barak shared with his wife and children was only a few steps down the corridor, Geryon went there, trying not to look back at the gray-cloaked attendant he knew was still following him. "Barak," he said, knocking on the big Kerak's door. "It's me, Geryon. May I come in?" The Lady Merrill opened the door immediately and curtsied respectfully. "Please don't do that," Geryon begged her.
"What's the trouble, Geryon?"
Barak asked from the green-covered chair where he sat, bouncing his infant son on his knee.
"I'm looking for Silk," Geryon replied, entering the large, comfortable room that was littered with clothes and children's toys.
"You're a little wild around the eyes," the big man noted. "Is something wrong?"
"I have just had some very unsettling news," Geryon told him, shuddering. "I need to talk to Silk. Maybe he can come up with an answer for me." "Would you like some breakfast?" Lady Merrill suggested. "I've already eaten, thank you," Geryon replied.
He looked at her a bit more closely. She had undone the rather severe braids she customarily wore, and her blonde hair framed her face softly. She wore her usual green gown, but her carriage seemed not to have the rigidity it had always had. Barak, Geryon noted, had also lost a bit of the grim defensiveness that had always been there previously when he was in the presence of his wife. Barak's two daughters entered the room then, one on each side of Erend. They all sat down in the corner and began playing an elaborate little game that seemed to involve a great deal of giggling.
"I think my daughters have decided to steal him," Barak grinned. "Quite suddenly, I am up to my ears and wife and children. And the funny part about it is, I don't seem to mind it at all."
Merle threw him a quick, almost shy smile. Then she looked over at the laughing children.
"The girls absolutely adore him," she said,
and then turned back to Geryon.
"Have you ever noticed that you can't look directly into his eyes for more than a moment or so? He seems to be looking right into your heart."
Geryon nodded.
"I think it might have something to do with the way he trusts everybody."
He turned back to Barak.
"Do you have any idea where I might find Silk?"
Barak laughed. "Walk up and down the halls. Listen for the rattle of dice. The little thief's been gambling ever since we got here. Jernik might know. He has been hiding out in the stables. Royalty makes him nervous."
"It does the same thing to me," Geryon said.
"But you are royalty, Geryon,"
Merrill reminded him.
"Oh, that makes me even more nervous," he replied.
There was a series of back hallways that led to the stables, and Geryon decided to follow that route rather than pass through the more stately corridors where he might encounter members of the nobility. These narrower passageways were used for the most part by servants going to and from the kitchen, and Geryon reasoned that most of the minor household staff would probably not recognize him yet. As he walked quickly along one of the passageways with his head down to avoid any chance of recognition, he caught another glimpse behind him of the man who had dogged his steps ever since he had left the royal apartment. Irritated finally to the point where he no longer cared about concealing his identity, Geryon turned to confront his pursuer.
"I know you're there," he declared. "Come out where I can see you."
He waited, tapping his foot impatiently. The hallway behind him remained empty and silent.
"Come out here at once," Geryon
repeated, his voice taking on an unaccustomed note of command. But there was no movement, no sound. Geryon thought for a moment of retracing his steps to catch this persistent attendant in the act of creeping along behind him. But just then a servant carrying a tray of dirty dishes came along from the direction Geryon had just come.
"Did you see anyone back there?"
Geryon asked him.
"Back where?"
the servant said, obviously not recognizing his king.
"Back along the hall?"
The servant shook his head.
"I have not seen anyone since I left the apartments of the King of Dresnia," he replied. "Would you believe that this is his third breakfast? I have never seen anybody eat so much."
He looked curiously at Geryon. "You shouldn't be back here, you know. If the head cook catches you, he'll thrash you. He doesn't like anybody in this hall who doesn't have business here."
"I'm just on my way to the stables," Geryon told him.
"I'd move right along, then. The head cook's got a vicious temper."
"I'll keep that in mind," Geryon assured him.
Lotharin was coming out of the stable, and he gave Geryon a startled look as the two of them approached each other in the snowy courtyard.
"How did you manage to escape from all of the officials?" he asked.
Then, as if remembering, he bowed.
"Please don't do that, Lotharin,"
Geryon told him.
"The situation is a bit awkward, isn't it?"
Lotharin agreed.
"We will behave toward each other the same as we have always behaved,"
Geryon said firmly.
"At least until they tell us we can't. Have you any idea where Silk might be?"
"I saw him earlier this morning," Lotharin replied.
"He said he was going to visit the baths. He looked a bit unwell. I think he celebrated last night."
"Well, let's go find him," Geryon suggested.
"I have got to talk with him."
They found Silk, sitting in a tiled stone room thick with steam. The little man had a towel about his waist, and he was sweating profusely.
"Are you sure this is good for you?"
Geryon asked, waving his hand in front of his face to clear an eddying cloud of steam.
"Nothing would really be good for me this morning, Geryon,"
Silk replied sadly. He put his elbows on his knees and sank his face miserably into his hands.
"Are you sick?"
"Horribly."
"If you knew it was going to make you feel this way, why did you drink so much last night?"
"Oh, it seemed like a good idea at the time. At least I think it did."
"I seem to have lost track of several hours."
An attendant brought the suffering man a foaming tankard. And Silk drank deeply.
"Is that really wise?"
Lotharin asked him.
"Oh, probably not," Silk admitted with a shudder. "But it is the best that I could come up with on short notice."
He shuddered again.
"I feel absolutely wretched," he declared. "Was there anything in particular that you wanted?"
"I've got a problem," Geryon blurted. He looked quickly at Lotharin.
"I'd rather this did not go beyond the three of us," he said. "You have my oath on it,"
Lotharin responded instantly.
"Thank you, Lotharin."
It was easier to accept the oath than try to explain why it wasn't really necessary.
"I have just read the Accords of Vomimbre. Actually, I had them read to me. Did you know that I'm supposed to marry Tsenedra?"
"I hadn't actually put that part together yet," Silk admitted.
"But the Accords do mention something about it, don't they?"
"Congratulations, Geryon,"
Lotharin exclaimed, suddenly clapping his friend on the shoulder.
"She is a beautiful girl."
Geryon ignored that.
"Can you think of some way I can get out of it?"
he demanded of Silk.
"Geryon, right now I can't really think of anything except how awful I feel. My first hunch, though, is that there isn't any way out of this for you. Every kingdom in the West is signatory to the Accords. And then I think the prophecy is involved, too."
"I had forgotten about that," Geryon admitted glumly.
"I am sure they will give you time to get used to the idea,"
Lotharin said.
But how much time will they give to Zenedra? I talked to her this morning, and she's not happy about the idea at all.
If she doesn't actually dislike you, Silk told him.
That's not what the problem is. She seems to think that I outrank her, and that's what's got her upset.
Silk began to laugh weakly.
A real friend wouldn't laugh, Garion accused him.
Is rank really that important to your princess?
Lelderin asked.
Probably not much more important than her right arm. I think she reminds herself that she's an imperial princess 6 or 8 times every hour. She makes a pretty big issue about it. And now I come along from out of nowhere, and suddenly I outrank her. It is the sort of thing that's going to set her teeth on edge. Permanently, I expect.
He stopped and looked rather closely at Silk.
Do you think there's any chance of your getting well today?
What have you got in mind?
Do you know your way around Riva at all?
Well, naturally.
I was sort of thinking that I ought to go down into the city, not with trumpets blowing and all of that, but just dressed like somebody ordinary. I don't know anything at all about the Rivens, and now...
He faltered with it.
And now? You are their king,
Lelderin finished for him. Though it's probably not a bad idea, Silk agreed.
Though I can't really say for sure. My brain isn't working too well just now. It'll have to be today, of course. Your coronation is scheduled for tomorrow, and your movements are likely to be restricted after they have put that crown on your head.
Garion did not want to think about that.
I hope the two of you don't mind if I take a little while to pull myself together first, though,
Silk added, drinking from the tankard again.
Actually, it doesn't really matter if you mind or not. It's a question of necessity.
It took the rat-faced little man only about an hour to recuperate. His remedies were brutally direct. He soaked up hot steam and cold ale in approximately equal amounts, then emerged from the steam room to plunge directly into a pool of icy water. He was blue and shaking when he came out, but the worst of his indisposition seemed to be gone. He carefully selected nondescript clothes for the three of them, then led the way out of the citadel by way of a side gate. As they left, Garion glanced back several times, but he seemed to have shaken off the persistent attendant who had been following him all morning. As they wandered down into the city, Garion was struck again by the bleak severity of the place. The outsides of the houses were uniformly gray and totally lacking any form of exterior decoration. They were solid, square, and absolutely colorless. The gray cloak, which was the outstanding feature of the Riven national costume, gave the people in the narrow streets an appearance of that same grimness. Garion quailed a bit at the thought of spending the rest of his life in so uninviting a place.